Very good morning. Thank you for joining us here at the UN office at Geneva today, Friday, the 29th of May. As usual, we have a very important agenda for you. We have the situation in South Sudan, in Gaza, in Lebanon, which is a last-minute addition. Happy to have Ricardo, who will be joining us shortly, on the podium. We also have updates from our colleagues from the World Health Organization on the Ebola outbreak in the DRC and in Uganda, as well as from the WHO, World No Tobacco Day announcement. And lastly, Zaina, I think Zaina is in the room or soon will be in the room. We'll have an update from her with the upcoming International Labor Conference. So without further ado, I'll throw to our colleague, Mutinta Chimuka of the World Food Program, who is the World Food Program's country director for South Sudan, who's joining us from Bor in South Sudan. So Chimutinta, over to you, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you very much for the opportunity to update on the situation in South Sudan and particularly in Akobo. I am currently in Bor in Jonglei State, where Akobo is also. I was in Bor yesterday with colleagues who are working on the ground, so I saw for myself the situation there on the ground. The World Food Program launched its emergency response there 3 weeks ago, and we're in a tight race against time to scale up our response. Since the beginning of this year, Akobo East has experienced relentless conflict. Approximately 142,000 individuals from Akobo and surrounding areas have been displaced, with 100,000 approximately crossing into neighboring Ethiopia. The latest Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, IPC update, reveals an alarming situation. Parts of Akobo County are confronting IPC 5 catastrophic stage, and this is one of four counties at imminent risk of famine should conditions deteriorate. Hundreds of thousands face acute food insecurity, with 12,000 currently in phase 5 catastrophic through to July. Malnutrition levels have escalated to IPC acute malnutrition phase 5, which is extremely critical, triggered by displacement, loss of livelihoods, disrupted health services, and increased disease threat due to overcrowding. Particularly concerning is the sharp rise in severe malnutrition among children under 5 and breastfeeding mothers, heightening the risk of famine-like conditions. Despite ongoing insecurity, damaged infrastructure, and the looming rainy season, WFP continues to deliver vital food and nutrition assistance. In only the last 3 weeks, we have reached over 60,000 people, including pregnant and breastfeeding women, with nutritious commodities and provided specialized nutritious food to children and mothers via supplementary feeding programs. Together with partners, WFP has conducted nutrition screening for 15,000 children and admitted 3,000 for treatment of moderate acute malnutrition. The arrival of the rainy season challenges humanitarian logistics. Mixed commodity transport relies heavily on air transportation. To date, over 60 WFP aviation flights, including airdrops and UNHAS passenger services, have moved 430 metric tons of assistance and transported over 200 aid workers. While access has recently improved, the rainy season limits road usage, making air deliveries crucial for maintaining uninterrupted support. Costly air operations also continue to persist due to insecurity. Sustainable and secure access is essential for aid recovery and restoring livelihoods. Just want to stress on the access. We at WFP had about 33 trucks that were en route and spent about more than 2 weeks en route instead of normally a 3-day route because of the very, very difficult road conditions. So just an example of how difficult it is to move in the rainy season here in South Sudan. On access and insecurity, the risk of renewed fighting is real. We need hostilities to end, and humanitarians must have continued secure access to ensure civilians are able to safely receive vital assistance. The World Food Programme is deeply concerned about the most vulnerable populations in inaccessible areas where hunger and malnutrition risks will worsen during the imminent lean season. To save lives, WFP urgently requires $266 million in funding in places such as Akobo and many others across the country. Akobo is an important part of where WFP and other partners would like to deliver in South Sudan, but it remains a part one area. We are talking about 7.2 million people who are in urgent need of food assistance that require our support and that of other partners. Thank you very much for your attention.
Mutinta, thank you very much. It's a dire situation, and thank you very much for keeping us abreast of it. So let's start off in the room for any questions. Yes, we have AFP, Agence France-Presse.
Hi. Thank you very much for the briefing, Nina Larson, AFP. I was wondering if you have a more precise figure on the, you said hundreds of thousands face acute food insecurity, if you have a more precise figure on that. And then there was mention last week, I think, from MSF that aid is being diverted for military use. Is that something that you're also seeing on the ground? When it comes to the insecurity in the country, how concerned are you about the drawdown of the number of peacekeepers that the UN has decided? Thank you.
Over to you, Mutinta.
Thank you very much for the question. So the entire population in Sudan, South Sudan, that needs food assistance is 7.2 million, which is a huge number, which is about 50% of the population of South Sudan. In Akobo itself, we're looking at about 160,000 who may be in need of food assistance. When it comes to insecurity remains a serious challenge. A lot of territory in South Sudan goes between different armed groups, and as you, I think, are aware, Akobo itself was under different hands until just a few weeks ago. As I was on the ground, we did speak with a county commissioner there who is very much appraised of that situation. However, it is really concerning because even our trucks, the trucks of other agencies, need to ply the Pibor Aboko Road, Akobo Road, with escort from UNMISS. So they've been very, very supportive to the World Food Programme and others on providing escort, and we're definitely concerned about their drawdown. But for now, we'll continue to be engaged with UNMISS and ensure that they work together with the humanitarians to ensure that we can provide food assistance. Where we are not experiencing at the moment issues with military, where is a concern right now is the fact that we have a number of incidents that could be considered as criminality, where sometimes commodities are at risk of being looted by armed gangs and the like, and that's why we really urge the government of South Sudan and other parties that can be involved in the dialogue regarding security to ensure that there is peace, safe access for humanitarians to be able to deliver our cargoes. Thanks.
Indeed. Thank you so much, Mutinta. For the questions, yes, Olivia, Reuters.
Sorry for the very ignorant question, but what UNMISS, is that the UN mission in Sudan? And can we just have some detail on what has the impact been? What's the drawdown impact been? Just a bit of context would be helpful in what we were referring to there. Thank you so much.
Mutinta, you want to, it's maybe your better place, you're in country, so please go ahead.
Okay, no, thank you so much, and apologies. Sometimes we speak in acronyms in the UN. So yeah, this is the UN mission for South Sudan. Due to a number of, resource constraints, some of the troop size has been reduced over the last couple of months. In Akobo, it definitely affects us directly. There is an Indian battalion in Akobo that is the battalion that is helping us to move to secure the area and supported us with the movement of our trucks, the 33 trucks that I had mentioned. This is one of the bases that was planned for closure. The closure date was supposed to be early next month. But yesterday we heard from the commander on ground that they will be extended by another month, which is essential for us. Like I said, the situation of insecurity is really very volatile here. So having peacekeepers and forces on the ground that can protect humanitarians is something that's really critical in order for us to deliver in Akobo.
Thank you. Thank you so very much. Maybe just to add, having worked myself in the country, it's a terribly logistical, it's a massive challenge to get things from point A to point B. And UNMISS has been there since 2011, after the independence of the new country, the latest member state. Thank you very much, Mutinta, for that. Do you have a follow-up? Yeah. Sorry, Nina, go ahead, AFP.
Yeah, thank you. Just on the funding, you mentioned that you needed $266 million. I assume that's this year. And how much of it have you received? How likely is it that you'll actually receive that amount? And what will the impact be if you don't? Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we have a number of generous donors that continue to support us, and we continue to be engaged here in South Sudan on the ground with them. And of course, this is also an opportunity for us to advocate for the needs through you and your messaging through your different outlets. Right now, the situation that I would say. We are not fully certain of receiving the $266 million that we require. What it would mean then is really doing drastic measures, which means already reducing ration sizes, which is something that we've already started to do. It would mean deprioritization, which is a horrible, horrible word to use. It means that certain people will not receive assistance. And if they are not able to receive assistance and they do not have access to food commodities because they do not at the moment, we just talked about how a number of places are facing imminent pockets of famine-like conditions. We don't have the luxury not to continue to raise this money. But what it would ultimately mean is that we may see people who are actually in famine-like conditions, which is something that we want to avoid. Already, we are doing reduced rations in many parts of the country to try and spread the resources as far as we can. I would like to just stress that in some parts of Sudan, South Sudan, there is ability to grow food, which is something that the people of South Sudan would like to do. However, because of conflict, some of the resources, the crops that people have grown have been destroyed. And that's why, again, the need for peace and stability is critical for livelihoods to continue. And yes, in some pockets, we do need humanitarian assistance, but we're also looking to see how we can do more long-term sustainable work where people can stand on their own 2 feet. But at this present time, we need to have resources in order to do airdrops, do road where we can, which is just a short window. And our window is really very, very tight. And so we need resources as soon as possible.
Absolutely. Message well received. Thank you, Mutinta. Do we have further questions in the room or perhaps online? I don't see that's the case. So on that note, I just want to thank you again for joining us, Mutinta. It's immensely important that your messages are conveyed to us here to create this massively needed response to this situation there. So thank you very, very much. And please do join us anytime, Mutinta. And I note that Thompson, our friend Thompson, is also connected online as far. So if you have any questions, you can also just reach out to Thompson and or Asfar. But thank you again, Mutinta.
No, thank you. Thank you all. Have a good morning.
Thank you. Same to you. Okay, moving to the north, to the situation in Gaza. Ricardo of UNICEF is online, and maybe I'll ask you to introduce our guest who's joining us from Gaza. Ricardo.
Thank you, Rolando. Good morning, everyone. Bonjour. Yes, Salim Owes, our communication specialist for the regional office in Amman, has been in Gaza for over 10 days now and is joining us today to speak about the situation on the ground, which is very, very dire for children. Over to you, Salim. Thanks for joining.
Thank you, Ricardo. Thank you, Rolando. Colleagues. In Gaza, the failure to meet children's basic needs is trapping them in an endless cycle of suffering. The experiences of the desperate parents I met this past week can illustrate this better than I could. Hind hadn't slept since her four-year-old daughter, Massa, was bitten by a rat during the night. Like many families, they sheltered wherever they could. In their case, the second floor of a building block where sewage water leaks through the ceilings and rodents crawl through the cracks in the building and climb the exposed pipes. Water, Limar.
Sorry, Salim, we just lost your audio. If you can repeat that last sentence again, let's see if we have you. Okay, go ahead.
Can you hear me now?
Now we can, go ahead.
Okay. So moving to Anani's daughter, Limar. She's seven, has developed deep lesions and sores on her head, back, and legs due to a bacterial infection. Amani tries to clean her wounds each day with the little hard-to-get clean water she has as her daughter screams in agony. Abdullah's mother told me that he has developed a skin infection as they live in a tent next to sand contaminated with feces. His mother has spoken to doctors and desperately needs the medication and enough clean water and hygiene products to help him heal and protect him from exposure to more infections. Abdul Alim said that his 8-month-old son, Ahmed, and his pregnant sister in law were both bitten a couple of weeks ago. They have layered sandbags around the outside of the tent to try to protect themselves, but the rats simply chew through it. Stopping them is futile. The common thread running through of these conversations is the sheer heartbreak of parents who no longer feel able to do the thing most innate to them, to protect their children's health and safety. One look at the conditions that people are being forced to live in is enough to understand why. We know that Gaza was already one of the most densely populated places in the world. Now people have been crammed into around 40% of the space left to them, sheltering among broken buildings, rubble, and mounting solid waste. Families across Gaza do not have enough clean water. They are forced to choose between drinking, washing, and cooking with what little they have. UNICEF is trying to reach as many people as possible with clean water, up to 1.5 million people a month, but there are significant obstacles. First, deadly attack on water operations, including recently at Al Mansoura filling point, where two UNICEF contracted truck drivers were killed whilst trying to collect water. Now, this main water filling station, which more than a quarter of a million people rely on, is inaccessible. Second, items needed to sustain water systems and repair damaged water infrastructure, including lubricant oil, water treatment chemicals, and spare parts, are not being allowed in at the scale needed, meaning we cannot repair systems as quickly as needed to reach more children with clean water. And existing systems risk failure due to lack of maintenance and overuse. If we cannot repair systems, then we have to rely solely on water trucking, which is much more expensive and doesn't reach populations as effectively. Thirdly, solid waste is piling up by the day. This, alongside rubble, needs clearing at a scale that is currently impossible because there is no accessible space left to clear it to. The effects of this are now apparent. Children with respiratory infections, acute watery diarrhea, and half of all households reporting skin diseases. Fleas, lice, and scabies are commonplace. Increasing numbers of children are requiring hospitalization, all without a single fully functioning hospital across Gaza. The picture is similarly stark when it comes to children's nutrition. While we have managed to reverse the famine, the number of malnourished and vulnerable children remain extremely serious. More than 2 years of food insecurity, poor housing, limited water, terrible sanitary conditions, and regular disease outbreaks has left the population extremely vulnerable. Without enough clean water and fuel to cook proper meals, even children who recover with treatment will quickly fall back in a cycle of malnutrition, the effects of which can last a lifetime. No parent should be in a position where they cannot provide their child with the basic needs to keep them healthy. No parent should have to watch as their child writhes in pain from lesions or buckle from weakness because of entirely preventable diarrhea. That this is happening should be, to everyone, entirely unconscionable. Access to water, adequate nutritious food, and healthcare should not be conditional for any child anywhere. UNICEF is calling for safe, unfettered access to deliver humanitarian operations, the lifting of restrictions on items needed to quickly repair and sustain water and sanitation systems, and for international humanitarian law to be upheld. Only then will children in Gaza start to break free from the cycle of suffering they are trapped in. Thank you.
Thank you so very much, Salim. If you could share your notes, or maybe Ricardo, because the sound, we heard most of it, but there were some parts where it was a little hard to understand. So we want to make sure not at all. We understand and appreciate the situation you're in, but we also want to make sure we capture every word of your important message. So I suppose, Ricardo, if you can share those notes. So let's start off in the room, AFP and then Reuters.
Yes, thank you, Nina Larson from AFP. Thanks for the briefing. I was wondering, yesterday Netanyahu said that Israel now wants to take control of 70% of Gaza, which would mean even less space than what you were describing. What's your reaction to that? How do you think that will impact the situation on the ground further, if you could have any comments? Thank you.
Well, as I said, the situation as is dire, and cramming people in a very small portion of the space is causing more problems than there already is. We're talking about this crowding is creating more spread of diseases. It's straining the systems and, of course, cutting so many of services. More of this will just mean that more children will suffer, more families will be challenged to meet their children's needs, and that, honestly, we can't afford at the moment.
Thank you, Salim. Yes, Olivia, Reuters.
Hi, Salim. Thank you very much indeed for this briefing. You mentioned in your remarks that there is an increasing number of children requiring hospitalization. I just wanted to get some detail on what they are requiring hospitalization for. Why is that number increasing? And do you have any figures just to help demonstrate that? Thank you.
Well, this is from my interactions with doctors and healthcare providers. Mainly, what I'm referring to here is cases of skin diseases, of rodent bites, and the such. And these are mainly due to sanitation and water issues. And that was reported by doctors in Gaza and by parents. A lot of children are developing, as I said, these infections. And in the lack of water and sanitation, these infections are becoming more troublesome to deal with. So that's why they need hospitalization. Of course, add to that the other diseases in terms of respiratory diseases and diarrhea and the such. We don't have a definitive number, but that's the reported trend among doctors and parents.
Okay, thank you so much, Salim. Let me check if there are further questions for you. Any follow-ups in the room, online? Yes, we have a question from Jamie of AP. Jamie.
Thank you, Salim. It's Jamie from Associated Press. I appreciate that. I wanted to just bounce back off of Nina's question. We're also hearing some talk of advocacy groups and aid organizations responding to this talk of a 70% control of Gaza by Israel. Could you just say how the news of that has affected your operations or your planning in terms of how you continue to operate? Thanks so much.
Well, unfortunately, for the past 2.5 years, we've been always forced to plan and replan our response. And that has been a real strain on the humanitarian response in Gaza, not only for UNICEF, but for the whole of the humanitarian corps. This means if it happens that we need to find another points of service providing, as what happened with Al-Mansoura water point, which now is inaccessible. Unfortunately, more of the land being taken means that we will lose access to some of the services points, but also for some hard-to-reach places that children, families are living there, and that means that it's going to be more complicated for us to reach and coordinate, which is already a problem.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Salim. Further questions, colleagues? No, I don't see that's the case. So, Salim, I can't thank you enough for connecting with us. Important to keep the spotlight bright on this situation, particularly of children and vulnerable people in Gaza. So thank you very much. And yes, if the notes could be shared, that would be most helpful. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rolando. Thank you, Elise.
Of course. We're going to stay with Ricardo, who has, as I mentioned, there is an update to the program, update on Lebanon in particular, on the children killed and injured over the past week. So, Ricardo, back to you.
Thanks, Rolando. And just to reinforce that, I will share the notes from Salim's briefing just now. Indeed, very dire what's happening in Gaza and moving to the neighboring country. I just wanted to share a staggering update from Lebanon, where according to the Lebanese Ministry of Public Health, 77 children have reportedly been killed or injured over the past week alone, 15 children killed and 62 injured in 7 days. That's an average of 11 children every 24 hours. We understand the vast majority of these children were impacted by airstrikes in South Lebanon. Only yesterday, 7 children were killed and 30 injured. A ceasefire or a lesser fire? Since the announcement on 17th of April, 55 children have been killed and 212 wounded. We reiterate the call for all parties to fully respect the ceasefire and to comply with international law at all times. Under international humanitarian law, children and civilian infrastructure must be protected at all times. Humanitarian organizations must be granted safe, timely, and unimpeded access to all affected areas, especially in the south of Lebanon, to deliver life-saving aid. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Ricardo. It's shocking, shocking update, but important to share. Thank you. Colleagues? Yes, Olivia Reuters.
Thank you, Ricardo. Sorry, just a clarification. An average of 11 children killed every 24 hours. Is that since the hostilities began or since this, yeah, ceasefire? Sorry, just to clarify that.
No, just thank you for your question, Olivia. Important to clarify the numbers because sometimes we combine them, and in this case it's 77 children killed or injured, so a figure on casualties, which is 15 children killed and 62 injured in 7 days, 11 children killed or injured every 24 hours in the past week alone. That's in the last 7 days. Since the ceasefire was announced on April 17th, we have 55 children killed and 212 wounded. I don't know what the average is there, but surely is a staggering one as well.
Thank you so much, Ricardo. And of course, the Secretary General is deeply, deeply concerned over the ongoing tensions in Lebanon. And he calls on parties to exercise maximum restraint and avoid further escalation in that country. So, for the questions in the room, online, I don't see that's the case. So thank you, Ricardo, for this update, and do keep us informed of developments. Okay, we're moving to back south to DRC and Uganda for an update from our colleagues from the World Health Organization. Christian is joining me here, as is Dr. Anes Legand, who has briefed us before. Dr. Legand is the part of the high threats pathogens team at the WHO Health Emergencies Program, and we're very pleased to have you here. I think you'll introduce in French and then also have some English comments, but again, thank you very much for being here with us.
Merci beaucoup. Bonjour à toutes et à tous. Et merci de me donner l'occasion de vous informer sur la maladie à virus Bundibugyo en République démocratique du Congo et en Ouganda. Je vais commencer par la République démocratique du Congo. Le 15 mai, la République démocratique du Congo a notifié à l'OMS une flambée de maladie à virus Bundibugyo. Au 28 mai, 125 cas confirmés ont été signalés, dont 17 décès, dans 13 zones de santé dans les provinces de l'Ituri, du Nord Kivu et du Sud Kivu. 16 cas confirmés ont été rapportés parmi des agents de santé. En outre, nous avons actuellement 906 cas suspects, dont 223 décès, qui font actuellement l'objet d'investigations. Les investigations se poursuivent, les capacités de détection s'améliorent et les cas suspects sont réévalués à mesure que les capacités s'améliorent et ces chiffres seront amenés à changer. L'OMS appuie le gouvernement, notamment en renforçant la surveillance, la recherche des contacts, les soins cliniques, l'acheminement des fournitures et la logistique, la mobilisation communautaire et la préparation transfrontalière. Parallèlement, l'OMS soutient les services de santé essentiels par l'intermédiaire de ses partenaires. Cela inclut les soins de santé maternelle et infantile, le traitement de la malnutrition, les services de santé mentale, le soin des plaies et des traumas, le soutien aux survivants et survivantes de violences sexuelles, la vaccination de routine et les services de santé communautaires. Cette flambée survient dans un contexte très complexe. Dans la seule province de l'Ituri, à peu près 1,2 million de personnes ont besoin d'une assistance humanitaire. Les conflits persistants et l'insécurité alimentaire rendent la riposte plus difficile. La mobilisation communautaire reste essentielle. L'expérience montre que des flambées de ce type ne peuvent être maîtrisées que lorsque les communautés sont pleinement impliquées dans la riposte. Un développement positif, pour conclure sur la RDC, Est également à signaler que le 27 mai, un patient a guéri et a quitté l'hôpital et a été déchargé dans la communauté. Je vais passer à l'Ouganda. Le 15 mai, l'Ouganda a signalé un cas confirmé chez un patient ayant voyagé depuis l'Ituri, en République démocratique du Congo, pour recevoir des soins en Ouganda. Au 27 mai, 7 cas confirmés, dont un décès, ont été signalés en Ouganda. 3 de ces cas ont été importés depuis la République démocratique du Congo. Les autres sont des cas contacts, y compris des agents de santé. Tous les cas en Ouganda sont actuellement liés par des liens épidémiologiques et il n'existe à ce stade pas de transmission communautaire documentée. L'OMS aide les autorités ougandaises à garantir la mise en place des mesures principales de riposte. Je vais passer maintenant au contexte global. Le 19 mai, le directeur général de l'OMS a convoqué le comité d'urgence du règlement sanitaire international qui a émis des recommandations temporaires le 22 mai. Ces recommandations soulignent l'importance d'une lutte coordonnée contre la flambée, d'une forte collaboration transfrontalière, d'une surveillance soutenue et de la solidarité. Sur la base des informations actuellement disponibles, l'OMS ne recommande aucune restriction en matière de voyage ou d'échanges commerciaux avec la République démocratique du Congo ou l'Ouganda. Enfin, l'OMS a réuni des experts mondiaux pour examiner les traitements et les vaccins candidats. Plusieurs produits candidats ont été identifiés pour des essais cliniques. Pour le traitement, 3 candidats thérapeutiques sont priorisés pour les essais cliniques. Les anticorps monoclonaux MBP-134, le Maftivimab ainsi que l'antiviral Remdesivir. Pour la prévention, l'antiviral oral Obeldesivir est priorisé pour une utilisation post-exposition chez les contacts de cas confirmés dans le cadre d'essais cliniques. En outre, 2 vaccins candidats ont été identifiés pour évaluation dès que des doses deviendront disponibles. L'OMS travaille en étroite collaboration avec les gouvernements des 2 pays pour soutenir l'évaluation de ces contre-mesures médicales, tout en augmentant en urgence les capacités de prise en charge afin de garantir que tous les patients aient accès à des soins de soutien optimisés qui peuvent sauver des vies. Comme on l'a observé lors des flambées précédentes, les mesures de santé publique fondamentales, comme la surveillance, la recherche et le suivi des contacts, la détection précoce, l'isolement et la prise en charge des cas suspects et confirmés, les mesures de prévention et de contrôle des infections, ainsi que les enterrements dans la dignité, sont efficaces pour interrompre les chaînes de transmission lorsque les communautés sont pleinement engagées aux côtés des autorités sanitaires. Ces mesures seront à nouveau essentielles dans cette riposte. Je vous remercie. I'll do that very, very briefly before we take questions. So let me switch to English very shortly. So to summarize the situation in the Republic Democratic of the Congo, as you know, on 15 May, Ministry of Health of the Democratic Republic of the Congo notified WHO of a Bundibugyo virus disease outbreak. As of 28th of May, a total of 125 confirmed cases have been reported, including 17 deaths in 13 health zones in provinces of Ituri, North Kivu, and South Kivu. 16 confirmed cases are healthcare workers. There is a total of 906 suspected cases, including 223 deaths, that are currently being investigated. Investigations are ongoing, and this figure will change, while testing capacities are being scaled up. My main point here is WHO supports the Democratic Republic of the Congo health authorities to scale up Bundibugyo virus disease intervention, but also support essential health services through partners. And this includes maternal and child health, treatment of malnutrition, mental health services, trauma and wound care, support for survivors of sexual violence, routine immunization, and community health services. This is to remind you that this outbreak is happening in a very complex context. In Ituri alone, 1.2 million people require humanitarian assistance. Ongoing conflict and food insecurity are making the response more difficult. Turning to Uganda, the health authorities of Uganda notified a confirmed case in a patient who had traveled from Ituri to in the Democratic Republic of the Congo to seek care in Uganda on 15th of May. As of 27th of May, a total of 7 confirmed cases, including one death, has been reported in Uganda. 3 of these cases were imported from DRC, and the other are linked contacts of those confirmed cases. Moving to the global aspect of this response, as you know, the emergency committee issued temporary recommendation on 22nd May. These recommendations highlight the importance of coordinated outbreak control, strong cross-border collaboration, sustained surveillance, and solidarity. Based on current information, WHO does not recommend any restriction on travel or trade with the Democratic Republic of the Congo or with Uganda. WHO brought together experts to review candidate treatments and vaccines, and several products have been identified to be assessed in clinical trials. For treatment of confirmed cases, 3 candidate therapeutics have been prioritized. 1 oral antiviral therapeutic has been prioritized for prevention for post-exposure exposure among contact of cases within a clinical study. My last word is for recalling that now we have these candidate therapeutics and vaccine. WHO is working closely with the government of both countries to support the assessment of this candidate medical countermeasure, while at the same time and urgently scaling up care capacities to ensure all patients in those affected communities can access optimized supportive care that can help save lives. As we've seen in previous outbreaks, core public health measures, including surveillance, contact tracing, early detection, isolation and care of suspected and confirmed cases, strong infection prevention and control in health facilities, along with safe and dignified burial, are effective in stopping chain of transmission when communities are fully engaged and empowered. These measures will be critical again in this response. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Merci beaucoup, Anes. We start off with a question in the room from Christian, German News Agency. Go ahead.
Merci, thank you. Si j'ai bien compris, les cas ne sont pas vraiment augmentés comme au début. Est-ce que ça veut dire que le pic soit passé ou est-ce qu'on a beaucoup de spécimens qui doivent encore être examinés? Et encore une question pour Christian. Nicht auf Deutsch. Can you give us an update on where Tedros is, what he does, how long he's going to stay, and what to expect? Thank you.
Merci. Je vais vous répondre en français. Merci de soulever effectivement ce point sur les chiffres. Et je pense qu'il y a eu certaines incompréhensions. Ce qu'il faut bien comprendre, c'est que les capacités de test sont en cours d'amélioration. Mais il y a effectivement eu un moment où un certain nombre d'échantillons, pour des raisons diverses, n'ont pas pu être testés directement. Le travail en cours par les autorités nationales de la République démocratique du Congo pour ce qu'on appelle reclassifier l'ensemble de ces cas. Par rapport à vous dire si le pic est passé ou pas, la réponse est, d'une part, les investigations sont en cours. Je ne pense pas qu'on puisse dire ça à ce moment.
Yeah, and on the whereabouts of the Director General, so the WHO Director General Dr. Tedros yesterday left for Kinshasa. He's currently in Kinshasa and will, during the next days, meet local partners, the authorities, and UN partners also in support of the Ebola outbreak of the authorities. Any further travel arrangements we'll update when we have them. Plans are developing.
Thank you both very much. Further questions in the room, online? Okay, we have a couple of questions online. Jeremy Lance, Radio France Internationale. Jeremy.
Thank you, Rolando. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Une question pour Madame Le Gan. Je voulais vous interroger par rapport au vaccin russe. Le patron du CDC Africa a exprimé donc le fait que la Russie avait manifesté la disponibilité, je ne sais pas si on peut dire ça comme ça, d'un vaccin russe qui serait uniquement destiné à la souche Zaïre, puisque l'OMS a répété que le vaccin Ervebo qui agit sur la souche Zaïre n'est à ce jour pas considéré pour juguler l'épidémie. J'aimerais comprendre en quoi le vaccin que la Russie prétend avoir développé pourrait avoir un effet quelconque sur l'épidémie actuelle. Est-ce que vous pouvez me donner des précisions là-dessus ?
Merci pour cette question. L'OMS invite tous les institutions qui auraient des vaccins qui pourraient être efficaces à bien évidemment partager leurs données. Pour le moment, les groupes d'experts qui ont revu les candidats vaccins disponibles à ce jour ayant des données cliniques ou précliniques n'incluent pas ce vaccin. Je n'ai personnellement pas vu ces données, je ne peux donc pas vous répondre à ce stade. Juste pour rappeler, l'OMS revoit l'intégralité des données précliniques et cliniques pour s'assurer que les bons produits puissent être évalués, encore une fois, on parle de produits investigationnels, dans le cadre de cette réponse pour le bénéfice des populations. Merci.
Nina.
Yeah, thank you for the briefing. So Nina Larson, AFP. I was wondering if you could say a bit more about the person who has recovered. What can you say about that? What kind of hope does that give? What recovery rate are you expecting to see? And also, I was wondering, the numbers you gave, I see there's a bit of an increase in the confirmed cases, but the suspected seem to remain the same since about a week or so. Why is that, and when do you expect to have, how accurate do you think that is? Because I guess that the number of cases is probably a lot larger, right?
I'll start with your own question around the numbers first, and then conclude with people recover, because it's very close to my heart. In terms of numbers, what you need to understand is when we have an outbreak, the most important thing is to try and identify anyone who could have symptoms that is suggestive of a specific disease. In that case, Bundibugyo virus disease. As you probably know, the symptoms are not necessarily very specific, especially at the beginning. So it can be thought that it's malaria or something else. That's what we are going to call suspect cases. The suspect cases to be will need to have laboratory testing to confirm whether or not they are indeed infected with Bundibugyo virus. So the number of suspected cases, by definition, is going to evolve. You will have the suspected cases that are tested positive and then become confirmed case. And then you have the suspected cases that will be reclassified as non-case, meaning they have been tested, they didn't test positive, they test negative for Bundibugyo virus and will be cared for accordingly to their symptomology. So that's why the number is evolving. As I mentioned, there were initially some delays in getting the sample to the laboratories, and the laboratories in both Bunia and Kinshasa are actively working on testing all these samples that couldn't reach earlier the laboratories. And based on this testing, a number of suspected cases will be reclassified as non-case for the one who tests negative or confirmed for the one who tests positive. I hope this clarifies. I know it can be challenging. On your second, actually on your first question, it's always something very positive that we welcome when people recover from disease that are very severe. From previous outbreak of Bundibugyo virus disease, the lethality, that is the number of people who died among people who were confirmed for the infection, ranges between 30 to 50%. It's huge. It means like up to 5 out of 10 people are likely to die. So having people who recover tells us two things. 5 people are likely also to recover, and we can do more. We can do more. We can scale up optimized intensive care. We can support the communities to recognize the symptoms early, to get early diagnostics so that they can receive the level of care they need. And also, you know, this disease transmits through close contact. It's a terrible disease because it's a disease that you get when you care for someone. When you care for your husband or your partner or your child or your mother, you get it when you want to help someone who is sick with symptoms. And this is terrible because this disease, to avoid getting it, you have to ask communities not to touch someone they love when they are feeling sick. But this is critical. And what's the most important thing is that we can support them to get early access to care. And when someone recovers, I mean, they go back to their community and there is a sense of hope showing that early access to care can help save life. There is a life outside of this disease. And what we've done in the past and what DRC has done with really great success is setting up survivor care program to follow any potential sequelae that these people may have and keeping the support that these people may need after they recover. And similar approach will be taken in this outbreak as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was a very thoughtful explanation, but I think Christian wanted to clarify one thing,
yeah,
maybe.
Just checking the 30 to 50% case.
Thank you very, very much for that explanation. Okay, we have lots of questions online and a couple in the room still, so maybe a follow-up from Nina, then over to you, Olivia.
Yeah, thank you. I wanted to follow on the case fatality rate because the situation report that was published earlier this week showed that the case fatality rate was at 24.6 or so, I think, for the suspected cases. And then for the confirmed ones, it was much lower. But I'm wondering what that says, if you expect that this outbreak actually has a lower case fatality rate than previous outbreaks of this species of Ebola, or if that's just because of the lack of numbers. And I had, just one final question you mentioned that you're not recommending travel restrictions. Italy has just said that they want to restrict access, tighten security around their borders. The U.S. obviously says no one is going to enter the country with Ebola, is really tightening the borders. What do you say to those countries who are, I guess, not necessarily following WHO recommendations? Thank you.
Thank you. For the case fatality ratio, so again, this is very preliminary to have a good understanding and an anticipation of what it will be in this outbreak. As I mentioned, there is still a number of suspected cases that have not been confirmed. There had been also reported deaths that couldn't be sampled, meaning that probably they were confirmed, but they are not including yet in the case count, and we will need further investigation to truly assess that. We cannot, as a general matter, just use numbers to define whether or not it's I will rephrase. The case fatality ratio is always a multifactorial, depending on access to care, depending on host population, depending on pathogen specific. In terms of this virus, the sequences have been released by both Uganda and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and is similar to what we've seen in the previous two outbreaks. So we are not expecting major change. However, we hope that by scaling up all the interventions that are being implemented in the ground, by getting people early access to care, early diagnostic, optimized supportive care, yes, we hope that this case fatality ratio will decrease, obviously. On the travel, as I mentioned, there has been some temporary recommendations that have been issued by the emergency committee. The recommendation is clear. People that are from the affected areas that are either contact of confirmed or probable case or suspected cases should not travel. The recommendation is also very clear. The Democratic Republic of the Congo and Uganda has to implement what we call exit screening border measures, sorry, which is currently being done. We encourage all countries to be in line with the international health regulation and to follow the temporary recommendation. Voilà.
Thank you. Sorry, thank you very much. Okay, Olivia, Reuters.
Hello, thank you. Just on the case who recovered, so just one case that's been confirmed of somebody recovered. Do we have any... And that was in, sorry, first question is, that was in DRC in the Congo. And secondly, do we have any understanding of their age or profile or something that was it the kind of early access to care that you think kind of led to their recovery? Just any more details about that case would be helpful. Thank you.
So I'm sorry, I'm not here to discuss patient confidentiality data. So I'm not going to talk about that.
Fair enough. Thank you very much. Okay, we'll go
maybe,
on.
Maybe to ask to say, if anything is to share tonight, still we're expecting a disease outbreak news coming out, the Dawn, an updated one. If there's anything to share, you would find it in there.
Thank you very much, Ms. Christian. Well noted. Okay, turning online, we have 1, 2, 3, 4 questions, starting with John Zarakostas, The Lancet, and Franz von Katz.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for the update briefing. I was interested, what's the latest in the field in increasing testing capacity, given there was an infusion of funds from Tom Fletcher towards the Ebola situation in the DR Congo, and also there's funds that the WHO has tapped into. So how many new laboratories are you setting up in the field? And will they have up-to-date diagnostic capacity to pick up all variants? Thank you.
Thank you. Just let me explain a bit further on the diagnostics. So the laboratory in Bunia is functional, up and running, and is able to test on two different platforms, able to differentiate Bundibugyo virus from the other filovirus. The issue that we have in the field is not necessarily an issue of resources. It's an issue of access. You may have heard in the news that Bunia Airport has been closed. And we thank the Republic Democratic of the Congo to allow humanitarian flights to still continue to go in Bunia. But access is not fully functional. One day, I got a call from my team telling me there is no fuel, or the flight couldn't leave because of the climate, or any single issues. All that is delaying timely and proper access. The lab in Bunia has now been fully supplied with the different PCR kits and is able to do the testing. But then there is still security access from other health zones to bring the sample to Bunia. So first, we are working with the Democratic Republic of the Congo to fix these issues. Also, a close-to-patient point-of-care PCR diagnostic is currently being validated in the field. If the data shows us that it performs well, there will be ability to decentralize the testing capacity as close as possible to patient care. This is work ongoing. Thank you.
Maybe just a bit of broader context, colleagues, to obviously underline that the humanitarian situation in Ituri has really been strained and remains deeply concerning. And if you might have seen reports of killings since early May, at least 150 civilians have been killed in Ituri province alone. So this is really overarching sort of concern, as we've been briefing you on, compounding the situation of Ebola. So we have more questions for you. Back in the room, no back online then. In this case, we have Jamie of the AP. Jamie, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Rolando. And thank you, Dr. Legault. I just wanted to follow up on the situation in terms of when you expect the time frame of being able to get the results back on the number of suspected cases, because I think a lot of people, as my colleagues have already been asking, are going to hear that, you know, in 4 days we have not seen the number of suspected cases go up from 900, you said 906. So that's going to raise a lot of questions. And I just want to make sure that, you know, that you can be really clear about whether or not you think this means that, you've said it before, but just kind of in passing, but, you know, does this mean that there is, there's still a way to go? You expect to see higher numbers of suspected cases. Could you just clarify, you know, what you think the trajectory of this outbreak is? Thank you.
Okay, I will re-clarify because I think there are still some confusion about that. I'm happy to see, I will say it very bluntly and very clearly, I'm happy to see the number of suspected cases to increase. Why? Because it means surveillance is working. It means we have teams in the ground that are able to early recognize patients who may have this disease. And that's what we call suspected. We think that while the testing is ongoing, and for the exact timeline, I would defer to my colleagues of the Institut National de Recherche Biomédicale in both Bunia and Kinshasa that are working tirelessly, as you say in English, to get all the samples being tested as fast as humanly possible. We are hopeful that most of the backlog of samples that has been reported in the past will be proceed in the next coming days. But then you need to understand that some work is needed to do the case reclassification. So expect this number to change a little. But again, if I see more suspected cases, it doesn't mean that more people have necessarily the disease. We are talking about suspected cases. It means the system works. And we need to encourage that and to follow it as close as we can. Over.
I think that's very clear. Thank you so much, Doctor. A couple more questions. Alina of TASS News Agency. Alina.
Thank you, Rolando. Good morning, everyone. Alina from TASS News Agency. And I thank you so much for the informative briefing. However, my question is meant for Christian, since I have an opportunity to catch him. It is not related to the situation in the DRC, but I hope it's all right. My question is concerning the U.S. withdrawal from the WHO. There previously have been discussions about how the outstanding contributions of the United States for 2024 and 2025 stand in the way of the process of withdrawal to be finalized from the WHO perspective. However, this question does not seem to have been raised during the World Health Assembly. So my question is, if you, Christian, could please give us an idea whether the WHO therefore officially acknowledges the withdrawal of the United States from the organization and considers the process of withdrawal to be finalized or not. Thank you very much.
Yeah, between
Congo. Let me quickly jump in here. So if you have followed the procedures, you will have seen that the member states discussed that if the U.S. remains further in arrears, voting rights may be stripped off in the next towards the next assembly. That's what they discussed. That's what they decided. That's where we are.
Very clear. Thank you so much. Okay, I think dernière question, Moussa Al-Mayadine.
Thank you. It's not concerning the Ebola topic.
No.
Another situation, if I...
Is it for OMS? It's for WHO?
WHO for concerning the situation, health situation in Lebanon for Kristen, I think.
Okay, let me just make sure there are no questions for Dr. Lagan. And I think there's still one more question for Dr. Lagan. Let's hold on to that, Moussa. Nina, back to you.
Sorry to harp on this. I just want, just on the patient that recovered, this is the first patient you're aware of that has recovered, and could you confirm that? And do you have anyone else who do you expect more recoveries to come in the coming days? I don't know what you're seeing in terms of how patients are doing. Thank you.
Of course, we expect more patients to recover. That's why we are scaling up those interventions. We hope that as many patients as we can will survive. This is. What is important about this patient is that he's the first one who was admitted to a care center who was discharged following two negative tests. Of the, I would say, unfortunately, of the person for which the lab results have not been received yet, probably some of them also recovered. And that's why we need this investigation to be concluded, to have the case classification to be concluded so that we can tell you. But yes, we are expecting more people to recover, of course.
Thank you very, very much, Dr. Legan. It's a...
Not doctor.
It's okay, well, I promoted you to doctor. But hold on a second, because I think we do have maybe... Is this Satoko? Is this for Anis? WHO?
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, but not the about the Ebola. I just
okay.
Want to
so
up the
we baby. Can release you. Thank you very much. Really appreciate your update. And this Christian, you're still on the hot seat there. Let's go. Maybe Satoko. Let me go back to Moussa. Moussa. Your question was on Lebanon, the health situation. But why don't you pose it and let's see if colleagues could respond to your queries. Go ahead, Moussa.
Yeah, just if there is any update about the health situation in Lebanon, especially in south of Lebanon, regarding the last update of the situation there. Thanks. So, Kristen, if you have some information about that.
Yeah, thank you very much, Moussa. No, unfortunately, I have nothing with me on Lebanon today. Sorry.
Thanks very much, Christian. I mean, I don't know if, of course... Ricardo, or Jens maybe, but Ricardo did brief on Lebanon, as you heard earlier, and if you have anything to add, just put your hand up. In the meantime, what I would like to do is maybe go back to Satoko-san before we go to our guest who's joined me on the podium. Satoko-san, Yomiuri, over to you. Do you have a question? Not
yes,
on Ebola,
thank you very
but
much.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to follow up the U.S. membership at the WHO. Christian, you said that the if U.S. remains further in arrears, their voting rights may be stripped in the next assembly, and that's what they decided. They is you are referring to the executive board or this assembly? Thank you.
Thank you. That was the assembly in their discussions. Yep. So all member states.
Okay, I think that's clear. Thank you so much. Maybe Moussa, just going back to your question, it's an important situation, which we, of course, have briefed on, but for the moment, we'll just need to get some figures for you, and feel free to liaise with Christian afterwards or as well with Ricardo or maybe Jens. There are updates from OCHA on the situation broadly in Lebanon. So thank you very much, Christian, for everything. Very pleased to have with us Dr. Prasad, Vinayak Prasad, who's the unit head of Tobacco-Free Initiative at the World Health Organization, who's going to speak about World No Tobacco Day for 2026. Over to you.
Thank you and good morning, colleagues. World No Tobacco Day happens to be on 31st of May. And just by way of reminder, more than 7 million people die due to tobacco every year. The theme for this year is Unmask the Appeal, Counter Tobacco and Nicotine Addiction. And for those who have followed World No Tobacco Day, even last year we had this broad theme, but this time is a more targeted focus on the nicotine and tobacco addiction, the way the tobacco and nicotine industry have designed products to attract and add a new generation, largely targeting children. And this is happening because the way sugars, cooling agents, flavors, they all mask the harshness of nicotine and gets promoted through digital marketing, lifestyle choices, almost glamorizing the addiction of these products. And so it's, again, mostly happening because where tobacco consumption is now seeing declines in 140 countries, and in some countries it's at very low levels. So these products are being targeted to get more of the addiction in the market again. And the tactic is to use to see how younger the people and the young the children can be addicted. For those who are tracking, for example, city-level progress, and in cities like Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, we just did a case study today which shows how one city could take intensified enforcement, strong measures, coordinated inspections, and awareness building at that level, in plus smoke-free legislation covering all these products. Those are examples which we want to use in terms of how government actions can be taken. A few weeks ago, we released this nicotine pouch report, and some of you had covered that, which was looking at how the industries use different marketing tactics to grab the attention of the young people on nicotine pouches, the fastest growing nicotine product at the moment. And the report did find that nearly 160 countries have not done any regulation. There are no regulation in places. And with this, due to the aggressive marketing of these products, especially with child-friendly flavors and media influences, we are seeing a major epidemic situation in a number of countries on with nicotine pouches. The possibility of action exists. Some countries have started, but governments are lagging behind in terms of regulation of these, both nicotine and tobacco products, especially which are being targeting the new generation. And these actions must be coupled with some more efforts to raise awareness, especially at the local and regional government level, so that they can take some actions to expose the industry tactics, but also to take corrective actions. But I think there's also hope, because more than 60% of the 1.2 billion tobacco users, that's the 750 million who want to quit. And then we do have evidence-based solutions to help these tobacco users quit. And again, for this World No Tobacco Day, that's where we are also emphasizing that while there is addiction, one can get free of this nicotine and tobacco addiction. And that is something very crucial. The toolkits exist. And we really need to see how those can be benefiting. So in closing, let me just say that our message is straightforward. The industry is profiting from addiction, and governments can act and communities can act. So it's important that every person understands that and gets that opportunity to get the support to quit. So thank you, and happy to look for questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Prasad. Important updates on this important occasion. Do we have questions in the room? Online? I think you were very, very clear in your brief, so thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for your patience in this update. Thanks for joining us here. Before we go to our last announcement, I think Christian wanted to double back to this situation of health in the Middle East broadly.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Dr. Prasad, first. It's challenging to come here between all these emergencies, but thank you for that important update. Yeah, Musa, we do have, I did get an update, so let me give you just a bit of an update on the health situation in Lebanon. To note that yesterday the new situation report, the new SITREP number 8 came out, dated 28 May, global situation report on the Middle East escalation of the conflict from WHO. And now on Lebanon specific, despite the ongoing ceasefire in Lebanon, the security situation remains highly volatile. There have been 1,774 injuries and 608 deaths since 16 April. The threat of expansion of military activities raises grave concerns for the health of the population. Since the ceasefire took effect, a total of 27 attacks on healthcare have been reported, causing 25 deaths and 42 injuries. To date in this conflict, a total of 16 hospitals and 13 primary healthcare centers have been damaged in attacks on healthcare. Three hospitals remain closed. Last week, the World Health Assembly adopted a decision on protection of healthcare in Lebanon. The resolution called for scaled-up international and WHO support to strengthen access to health services in conflict settings. Access to maternal health services and acute medical care remains critically constrained south of the Litani River, with patients facing delays of up to 48 hours to secure clearance for movement to referral facilities, posing serious risks to patient outcomes, including increased maternal and neonatal morbidity and mortality. Preliminary findings from a rapid health assessment conducted in May 2026 across 15 affected districts indicate that access to healthcare remains severely constrained, with 60 to 80% of households unable to afford services, particularly medications and hospitalizations. There are many outstanding needs. Flexible and rapid funding is urgently required to sustain emergency health operations and ensure uninterrupted life-saving services. Enhanced access is critical to restore outreach services. Expanded shelter and community-based surveillance is required to ensure early detection and rapid response to communicable disease threats. Expanded risk communication and community engagement are needed to improve awareness of available services, encourage early care seeking, and reduce health risks. Replenishment of essential medicines and supplies is needed to ensure service continuity. Through the WHO-coordinated Global Outbreak Alert and Response Network, GORN, a request for assistance for the Middle East escalation of the violence in Lebanon was issued to support the response with epidemiological and surveillance expertise. To date, WHO has distributed 120 trauma backpacks to ambulances and emergency medical services teams. WHO continues to support trauma hospitalization for non-Lebanese patients for the current escalation of hostilities that started since 2 March, with a total of 101 individuals supported to date, the majority Syrian, complementing government efforts to ensure proper coverage for all affected populations. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Christian, for sharing this update with us here, and of course, this complements what Ricardo briefed on earlier, this very difficult situation of children in Lebanon, as well as just to remind you that OCHA also shared an update, which I have here, last night on the humanitarian situation overall in Lebanon. So do you have something else? Yeah.
Go ahead. To add on what Dr. Prasad just said about World No Tobacco Day, there is a World No Tobacco Day toolkit, which is available online with lots of material for all the follow-up on that also quite important topic. Indeed. Another pandemic.
Indeed, yes, absolutely. Thank you so much, Christian. I don't see further questions for WHO for you, Christian, so thank you so very much. brings us to our last speaker, who I'd like to thank for your patience and for joining Zeina of ILO update on the International Labour Conference starting this weekend. Over to you, Zeina.
Thank you very much, and good morning, colleagues. Thank you for your patience with today's briefing. I won't be long. Just a reminder that on Monday, the International Labour Conference, the annual conference of the ILO, will begin, and it's going to be running until the 12th of June. As some of you are aware, this year it's over three different sites: the ILO building itself, the Geneva International Conference Center, CICG, as well as the Palais. A number of committee discussions, including Committee on Platform Economy, on Gender and World of Work, Gender Equality and World of Work, Social Dialogue, and the CAS, which is one of the functions of the standard setting of the ILO. If you would like any questions on any of them, including the topics that will be discussed, please do feel free to reach out to us, and we would be very happy to support. Of course, in addition to that, we also have our opening at the plenary, which is going to be at the Assembly Hall at the Palais, as well as the closing and a number of side events. All the information is available on the website. In fact, the website is being updated on a day-to-day basis. So if there's any document that's missing, chances are it will be up before the actual event. And if there's an updated document, it'll also be up on our website. All information as well on accreditation is also available there. Just to clarify that UN accredited colleagues will have access to UN Palais, to the CICG, and will need that extra ILO badge to join the ILO building for if you are interested in joining us there. And as last year and the year before, we have the engagement zone, which is the zone where we will be showcasing a virtual reality film. This year it's on child labor in Nigeria. We're also going to have our lunchtime conversations, which are informal, engaging panels discussing a number of important topics in the world of work, and also the Meet the Experts, which is a corner where ILO experts on a day-to-day basis will be briefing on different areas of our work. So please do not hesitate to reach out if you have any questions. You've got my contact, you have our email, which is newsroom@ilo.org, and we are here to support. Thank you so much. Back to you, Rollo.
Thanks to you, Zeina. We have a couple questions for you. Three questions for you, starting with Nina.
Thank you, Zeina. I was wondering, do we know who will be attending? Do we have a list of high-level participants and how many will be coming? And also, when it comes to covering the platform economy discussions, what can we expect from that? When are those scheduled for? Are we expecting sort of a vote? Do you have a program for those negotiations? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nina, for your question. So on the second question, the expectation or the hope is that we will be able to adopt a new standard governing the platform economy and the world of work. You may or may not be aware that the conversation got longer, and this year we are continuing the conversation. The draft of the recommendation for this and convention text for this standard setting is already online. And the process is one whereby the different delegates who are part of that discussion will be contributing to the draft. And the hope really is that we will get a new instrument governing the world of work and the platform economy. In terms of access, please do reach out bilaterally. We're still having internal discussions about the different committees, and I'd be happy to keep you posted in terms of what the options are what the situation is. And the discussion begins during the first week. The schedule is also online, and I can share it with you if you would like bilaterally. It's basically a table that has different day and the different discussions going on. And in that table, they also embed key documents relating to the different discussions that are taking place.
Thank you, Zeina. I think the schedule would, I think most would appreciate that. So if you could share, that would be very helpful. Did you have a follow-up? Go ahead, Nina.
Sorry, just on the attendees, the first part of my question.
Oh, sorry. Yes. At the moment, we have not been briefed on. We know that there are a number of ministers attending. I wouldn't be able to tell you right now who, because we're still waiting for final confirmations. We haven't been, at least I haven't been notified of the head of state.
Gotcha. We'll watch that space, of course. A couple more questions. John Zarkostas.
Yes, good morning. I was wondering if you can give us a bit of a summary. What are the countries that will be reviewed for violations under the Standards Committee? And secondly, President Lula has been a regular to the ILO annual meetings. Is there a prospect that he will be dropping in? Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. I don't have any information on President Lula, any other president, I'm afraid. I'm sorry about the noise. I'm working from home today. My apologies. Also, in terms of the standard setting committee, that's a good question. I don't have the list of the countries that will be selected to be further examined. However, we do expect to get that list in the first couple of days of the ILO. Of the ILC.
Gotcha. Thank you so much. Last question, Maya, the brief.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my question. It's just a follow-up on the question by Nina regarding also access to the ILO building. Do we have to call someone or do we need to make a special badge when we arrive there?
Thanks, Maya. Thanks very much. And thanks for your email as well. We're going to be getting back to you on that. But just to let you know, you do need a different badge for the ILO building, and we'd be happy to support you with that. We'll liaise with you on email.
Okay, thank you so much, Zaina. I think that does it for questions to you. So thanks and good luck for this important ILC coming up next week. Almost done, colleagues. Just a few announcements to make sure you're on the right track. We had shared with you earlier this morning a remarks from the Secretary General to the Security Council on the situation in Ukraine. The Secretary General refers to the serious violations of international humanitarian law in Ukraine. It mentions that the human toll is increasing. In the first 4 months of this year, the Secretary General says more civilians have been killed in Ukraine than in the same period in 2025, 2024, or 2023. Secretary General says, quote, "What is needed now is de-escalation, immediate and sustained. What is needed now is full unconditional ceasefire. What is needed now is more diplomacy. What is needed is to create conditions for a just, lasting, and comprehensive peace." Secretary General's comments on Ukraine, so do take a look at that. We also shared with you yesterday comments that the Secretary General had briefed the General Assembly yesterday on the UN-80 initiative. They're a very comprehensive update on this important initiative, which we shared with you. We also have some facts and figures on the initiative, the progress report on the UN-80 initiative. If you're interested, do let us know. We can share or point you to where those are located. Meetings taking place here. We have the Committee on the Protection of the Rights of All Migrant Workers and Members of Their Family, otherwise known as the CMW, opened in Pali Wilson yesterday. The committee is reviewing this Monday, the 1st of June, and Tuesday, the 2nd of June, the reports. Sorry, let me just reread that. Excuse me. Okay, sorry. The report of Ghana will be reviewed on Tuesday, the 2nd of June, and Wednesday, and going back, sorry, I'm messing this up, so let me start again, okay? The Committee on the Rights of Migrant Workers, so Monday and Tuesday, Ecuador, it's clear. Tuesday, Wednesday, Ghana, I think that's clear enough, so thank you very much. A conference on disarmament also is underway, as you well know, on Tuesday, the 2nd of June. The conference will hold a plenary meeting on effective international arrangements to assure non-nuclear weapon states against the use or threat of use of nuclear weapons, which, as you know, has been the subject of a very important meeting in New York last week. Just a note that we heard about the situation in South Sudan at the onset of this briefing. We have the Security Council meeting, public meeting on the situation of Sudan and South Sudan later today, 4 p.m. our time. For Tuesday, the regular press briefing will start early, as we mentioned to you in a small note that we shared on Tuesday the 2nd, the press briefing will start at 10 a.m. with the participation of Celeste Salo, the Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization, and Wilfrin Okia, who's the Chief of Climate Prediction. They're going to be briefing you on their El Nino update. So an important update indeed at 10 a.m. here ahead of our briefing on Tuesday. Today is Peacekeepers Day, the International Day of United Nations Peacekeepers, which is celebrated every 29 May. Important moment to reflect on the sacrifice made by peacekeepers across the globe. This year's theme is Invest in Peace. And this year, the UN office at Geneva will mark this important day this coming Tuesday, the 2nd of June, at 3 p.m. at a ceremony in the Ariana Park just behind me. There will be speeches. Alessandra Vellucci will be delivering statement on behalf of the office. We'll have statements from the French and Indonesian ambassadors, significantly given the situations they faced in Lebanon, as we've heard about earlier. So it's an important event to mark this important observance on Tuesday at 3 p.m. And we also have some press releases that were shared with us on New York on the recipients of the top military and police peacekeeping awards, which we're happy to share with you. And that is all I have. So any questions? Maya, is that for me? Must be, because I'm the only one here. Go ahead, Maya.
Yes, thank you very much. No, it's just a follow-up with Zina regarding the list, if she could send it to us when she has the attendees list and also the calendar that she mentioned to Nina, so we can pick and choose the meetings we can attend. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Maya. Just a clarification. Yes, I'll send the link to the to the online timetable that I mentioned that explains which discussions are happening when, and it has embedded in it a number of the relevant documents. But I didn't quite understand the other part of your request, a list of what? What was the other part?
It was to do with the schedule that you alluded to earlier, if I'm not mistaken, Maya.
That's the one. Yeah, what I just mentioned now. Okay.
Yeah, the list of attendees, the ministers and head of state, once you have that.
So I wouldn't be able to send that. However, we do have online a link with everybody who has been accredited. So I can share that because that's updated in real time. So you'll have those and you can check on a daily basis.
Right, the government representatives and all that. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks to you, Maya and Zeina, and thank you all for your attention and your reporting, and see you here on Tuesday. Thanks.